I think he went outside for a smoke, Abel said. He disappeared for a moment and came back with his brother in tow, rain misted in his dark curly hair.
Sorry.
Ezra's smile was somehow a little twisted, as if there was a joke only he was party to.
I didn't realise you were going to be pulling the old Hercule Poirot thing. Mr. Tresick, are you about to reveal Mother's murderer?
Not at all,
Mr. Tresick said, his face tightly disapproving. He shuffled his papers again and pushed his glasses up his nose with his knuckle, plainly ruffled by Ezra's levity.
And I hardly think that's appropriate, given... Well, never mind.
He coughed again, rather artificially, and seemed to marshal his thoughts.
Regardless, thank you all for this moment of your time. This won't take very long. But it's my understanding, from speaking to Mrs. Westaway, that she hadn't discussed her testamentary arrangements with her children. Is that correct?
Harding was frowning.
Not discussed as such, no, but there was a very clear understanding following my father's death that she would continue to live in the house until her own passing, at which point it would pass.
Well, that is my concern,
Mr. Tresick said hastily.
That there should not be any mistaken assumptions. I strongly encourage all clients to discuss their wills with the beneficiaries, but, of course, not all choose to do so. And it's my understanding that your mother didn't communicate her intentions to anyone.
There was the sound of a cane in the hallway, and Mrs. Warren came into the room.
What is it?
She said rather crossly, and then, seeing one of Harding's children putting coal onto the fire,
"Don't go wasting coal, young man."
"Do you have a moment, Mrs. Warren? I wanted to talk to all beneficiaries of Mrs. Westaway's will, and it seems fairest to do it at the same time."
"Oh,"
said Mrs. Warren, and a look came over her face that Hal couldn't quite pin down. There was something expectant about it, but Hal didn't think it was greed, more a kind of trepidation. It might almost have been glee. Did Mrs. Warren know something the others did not? Abel pulled out the piano stool, and the housekeeper seated herself, resting her cane against her lap. Mr. Tresick cleared his throat, picked up the file of papers from the polished piano top and shuffled them again, quite unnecessarily. Every inch of him, from his polished brogues to his wire-rimmed spectacles, signalled nervous discomfort, and Hal felt the back of her neck prickle. She saw a concerned frown line knitting an anxious furrow between Abel's brows.
Well, now, I will try to keep this brief. I'm not in favour of the Victorian-style theatrics involved in public will readings, but there is something to be said for transparency in these matters, and the last thing I would want is people committing themselves on a mistaken assumption of...
For goodness sake, spit it out, man!
Harding broke in impatiently.
Harding!
Abel put a placating hand on his brother's arm, but Harding shook it off.
Don't Harding me, Abel! Clearly there's something he's circling around, and I for one would like to cut to the chase and find out what it is. Did Mother go cracked and leave everything to Battersea Dogs Home or something?
Not quite, Mr. Tresick said.
His eyes darted to Harding, and then to Hal, to Mrs. Warren, and then back to Harding, and he reordered the papers again and settled his glasses more firmly on the bridge of his nose.
The long and short of it is this. The estate comprises some £300,000 in cash and securities, most of which will be swallowed up by death duties, and the house itself, which is yet to be valued, but is by far the most substantial part of the whole, and will certainly run in excess of £1 million, possibly two, depending on circumstances. Mrs. Westaway left several specific bequests. £30,000 to Mrs. Warren. The housekeeper gave a tight nod. And £10,000 to each of her grandchildren. At those words, Hal felt her pulse quicken and her cheeks flush. £10,000. £10,000? Why, she could pay off Mr. Smith, pay the rent, the gas bill. She could even afford to take a holiday. A flickering warmth was spreading through her as though she had drunk something particularly hot and nourishing. She tried not to smile, tried to remember that there were a lot of hoops still to negotiate, but the words kept repeating themselves inside her head. £10,000. £10,000! It was all she could do to stay still on the spot when every particle of her wanted to dance with excitement. Could it be true? But Mr. Trezick was still speaking. Excepting, that is, her granddaughter Harriet. Oh. The sensation was like a balloon pricked of air, collapsing in on itself into a sad little pile of coloured rubber, faster than it took to describe. In that one sentence, it was over. She imagined the £10,000 blowing away into the sea breeze, the notes fluttering over the cliff edge into the Atlantic. There was a wrench in letting the dream go, but as she watched the notes disappear in her mind's eye, she realized it had been an absurd fantasy to think that she could get away with this. Farcical, really. Forged birth certificates, fake dates of birth. What had she been thinking? Well, it was over, but at least she hadn't been found out. She was no worse off than she had been before. As for what she would do about Mr. Smith and his messengers, well, she couldn't think about that now. She just had to get through this and get away. It felt cruel, though, to have the promise dangled before her for that one moment, only to be snatched away. As the adrenaline of exhilaration ebbed away, a sense of great exhaustion was creeping through her, and she put out a hand to steady herself on a chair. As Mr. Trezick cleared his throat, preparatory to continuing. "To Harriet," he said, a little awkwardly, and he shuffled the papers again, as if reluctant to say what was coming. "To, Harriet, Mrs. Westaway has left the entire residue of her estate after payment of death duties." There was a long silence. It was Harding who exploded first, his voice breaking into the hush.
"What?"
"I did realise that this was liable to be something of a shock," Mr. Trezick said diffidently. "That was why I felt it only right to inform you
"To hell with that!"
Harding shouted.
"Are you insane?"
"Please don't raise your voice, Mr. Westaway. It's unfortunate that your mother didn't see fit to discuss this with you while she was still—"
"I want to see the wording,"
Harding said through gritted teeth. "Wording?"
"The will. The wording of the bequest. Well, challenge it. Mother must have been crazy. When was this monstrosity dated?"
"She made her will 2 years ago, Mr. Westaway, and I'm afraid that while I appreciate your concern, there is no question of Mrs. Westaway's capacity
She asked her doctor to visit her on the day she made the will, with a view, I believe, towards avoiding any such successful challenge.
Undue influence, then!
I don't believe Mrs. Westaway had ever met her granddaughter, so it's hard to see how that would stand up in court.
Give me the damn will!
Harding shouted, and he snatched at the piece of paper Mr. Treswick held out. Hal was holding on tight to the back of the chair, her fingers numb and white with pressure, feeling the eyes of Mitzi, Abel, and Ezra on her as Harding scanned down the long document and began to read aloud.
I, Hester Mary Westaway, being of... God, there's pages of this stuff. Ah, here we are. And to my granddaughter, Harriet Westaway, last known to be resident at Marine View Villas, Brighton, I give the residue of my estate. Jesus fucking Christ, it's true. Mother must have been mad.
He groped his way to a sofa and sat, heavily scanning up and down the document as if looking for some kind of explanation. Something that would make this madness go away. When he looked up, his face was purple and suffused with blood.
Who even is this girl? We don't know her from Adam.
Harding,
Abel said warningly, and he put out a hand to his brother's shoulder.
Calm down. This isn't the time for...
And as for you, Treswick, you bloody charlatan! What business had you letting Mother execute a document like this? I should sue you for malpractice!
Harding!
Mitzi broke in more urgently.
Abel, Mr. Treswick, look at the girl!
I think she's going to faint,
said a voice tinged with a sort of detached interest from Hal's right, and she felt all the heads in the room turn towards her, even as the room itself began to disintegrate into fragments. Hal didn't feel the chair slip from her loosening grip, and Mitzi's cry of alarm came as if from a great way off. She didn't even feel the thump as she hit the floor. The nothing washed over her like a great, thankful wave.
Chapter 14
Harriet!
The voice in Hal's ear was persistent, dredging her up from far below where she seemed to have been drifting a great while.
Harriet! Come on now, it's time to wake up.
And then, as if to someone else, her temperature's still high, her forehead feels like a radiator. Hal blinked, screwing up her eyes against a brightness that hurt.
What? How?
Her throat was sore and dry.
Oh, thank goodness. We were getting worried.
It was a woman's voice. And Hal blinked again and reached for her glasses. She slipped them over her ears, and the room slid into focus. First, Mitzi's face, and then behind her the figure of a man, Abel, she thought. Everything came back. St. Piran, the funeral, the house, and... Oh, God, that scene with Harding.
Here,
Mitzi said. There was a rustle, and a glass of water loomed under Hal's nose.
Have some of this. You've been asleep for ages. You must be very dehydrated.
What time is it?
Getting on for 9. We were getting quite worried. Abel and I were just discussing whether we should take you to A&E.
What happened?
Looking down, she saw she was lying on a couch of some kind, her dress rucked up to her thighs, although, thank God, there was a blanket over her legs. The room was one she didn't recognize, some kind of library by the looks of it.
with honey-coloured shelves rising to a high, damp-speckled ceiling and ranks of peeling, leather-bound books swathed in cobwebs.
"You just keeled over. And when we went to try and help you, you were burning up. It's a good job you're a skinny little thing."
"How are you feeling, Harriet?"
It was Abel, speaking for the first time, his light tenor soft and anxious. He came and knelt beside the couch and touched her gently on the forehead. Hal had to fight not to pull away from the intrusion of his touch, but his knuckles were cool.
"Do you want us to call a doctor?"
"A doctor?"
Hal struggled up against the sofa cushions, setting dust motes spinning in the golden light of the reading lamp. She imagined Abel picking her up from the floor, her skirt around her hips, and felt her cheeks flare with heat.
"God, no. I mean, thank you, but I don't think..."
"I'm not sure our chances of getting an out-of-hours GP are very good," Abel said. He stroked his moustache thoughtfully. "But if you're feeling nauseous, perhaps we should try A&E.
"I don't need a doctor," Hal said, trying to sound firm.
"She's still very hot,"
Mitzi said, talking over Hal as if she hadn't spoken.
"Do you think your mother has a thermometer anywhere?"
"Goodness knows," Abel said.
He rose, dusting off his knees.
"There's probably some lethal Victorian apparatus involving mercury in the medicine cabinet. I'll go and have a look."
"Oh, would you? You're a darling. Rich's iPhone has some app that claims it can take a temperature, but I can't see how it can possibly be accurate."
"I'm fine," Hal said.
She swung her legs to the floor and was met with a chorus of clucking disapproval from Abel and Mitzi.
"Darling,"
Abel put a hand on her shoulder, pressing her back into the couch.
"You just went white as a sheet and keeled over. The one thing you are definitely not is fine. Now, if I leave you alone with Mitzi to go and find a thermometer, do you promise not to go running off?"
"I promise," Hal said, only half reluctantly.
She put her legs back on the couch and lay back, shading her eyes from the glare of the lamp. Mitzi saw the gesture and bent over.
"Is the light hurting your eyes?"
"A little bit," Hal admitted. "You don't have any painkillers, do you? My head's really hurting."
"I'm not surprised,"
Mitzi said, a touch of tartness in her voice as she angled the lamp to the side, pointing it away from Hal's face.
"You came down with quite a whack on the parquet. There's an impressive egg on the side of your head. It's a shame you didn't go down the other way. You would have hit the rug, although it's so threadbare I'm not sure it would have done any good. Yes, I have some paracetamol in my handbag, but it's in the other room. Will you be okay while I go and fetch it?"
Hal nodded, and Mitzi stood up.
"Don't do anything silly now. I don't want you passing out again."
"I won't,"
Hal said faintly. She didn't mention that the idea of 10 minutes alone while Mitzi hunted for her handbag was even more alluring than the painkillers. As the door shut behind Mitzi, Hal let her head fall back onto the couch and tried to think, to piece together what had happened in the strange, frantic interlude between Mr. Tresick's announcement and her passing out. Because it didn't make sense. None of this made sense. She was named in this woman's will, personally named, along with her address. The will was referring to her. There could be no doubt at all. Could it possibly be true? Was she Mrs. Westaway's long-lost granddaughter? A flicker of hope began to burn, almost painful with the intensity of longing. "Be skeptical, Hal," her mother's voice whispered in her ear. "And be doubly skeptical when it's something you want to believe." And that was the problem. She was telling herself this, not because it was possible, but because she wanted it to be so. It could not be true, however much she might want to persuade herself of that fact. Her mother's birth certificate contradicted it absolutely. However Hal twisted the possibilities in her mind, there was no way she could make the connection work. Her mother might possibly be related to this family in some distant way. Westaway wasn't that common a name. But unless Hal ignored the evidence, not just of her own birth certificate, but of her mother's too, there was no way she could be Hester Westaway's granddaughter. Which meant, Hal tried to think back to what Mr. Trezick had said in the graveyard. Was it possible that the mistake had occurred not after the will was written, but before? Had Hester Westaway hired someone to track down her daughter, and somehow they got their wires catastrophically crossed? Hal pressed her fingers into her eyes, feeling the fever flush on her cheeks, and her head throbbed as if it would burst.
"Here we are!"
The voice came from the doorway, and Hal opened her eyes to see Mitzi walking briskly across the library, a white packet in her hand.
"Take two. They should help your temperature as well." "Ah, Abel," she said, as one of the bookcases swung back and her brother-in-law appeared in the opening with something in his hand. "Just in time. Is that the thermometer?"
"Yes."
He held it out, the bulb glinting silver in the lamplight.
Somewhat to my own astonishment, I was right. It is mercury, so for heaven's sake don't chew on it, Harriet. I don't want to be responsible for poisoning my own niece.
My own niece. Hal felt her cheeks flush involuntarily as he slipped the glass tube beneath her tongue, cool against the heat of her mouth, but she couldn't answer, only close her lips around it and watch as Abel turned to Mitzi.
"Edward rang from a garage near Bodmin. He won't be long now. He was sorry not to come to the service, you know, but he was on duty at the hospital, and he never met Mother, so it seemed a little hypocritical to ask him to take a day off."
"Still," Mitzi said, "he is your husband."
"Partner, dear Mitzi, partner. There's a difference, at least in the eyes of human resources. Parents-in-law, you get an automatic entitlement to compassionate leave. Estranged mother of your live-in boyfriend, not so much. Edward is my partner," he added to Hal. "He's a doctor, and I think we'll all feel much happier when he's given you the once-over."
Hal nodded, feeling the glass thermometer chink against her teeth. Mitzi and Abel lapsed into silence, and they all sat listening to the voices rise and fall from the next room, Abel meditatively stroking his moustache with one finger.
"Has Harding calmed down?" he asked.
Mitzi rolled her eyes and shrugged.
"Not a great deal. I'm sorry about my husband," she said, turning to Hal. "It wasn't a very edifying little display, I realise, but you have to appreciate it was a terrible shock. As eldest, I think Harding had naturally assumed..."
"It's understandable," Abel said. "Harding spent all his life trying to prove himself to Mother, and now he gets this, from beyond the grave. Poor man."
"Oh, Abel, stop being such a saint," Mitzi said. "You have an equal right to be upset."
Abel sighed. He shifted his position on the threadbare armchair, tugging at the knees of his trousers to avoid stretching the fabric.
"Well, I wouldn't be human if I didn't admit to a bit of chagrin. But the difference is, Mitzi, darling, I've had 20 years to get used to the situation. I resigned myself years ago to Mother's disapproval."
"My mother-in-law cut Abel off without a penny," Mitzi explained to Hal, a touch of righteous disbelief in her voice.
"It was quite a shock at the time,"
Abel said, rather wearily.
"But there we go, it was a different era."
"It was 1995, Mitzi snapped. "Your mother's views were dated even then, Abel. Don't excuse what she did. Personally, in your shoes, I don't think I would have even attended the funeral. There's such a thing as being too nice, you...
Well, regardless, Abel said, raising his voice and cutting through her. I didn't expect to get a penny in the will, so it's no shock to me.
Well, I applaud your level-headedness. But aren't you surprised for Ezra? Harding always said he was your mother's favourite.
Abel shrugged. As a little boy, yes. But, you know, as an adult, he cut himself off from all of us, mother included. I think it was just too... After my sister, our sister, after she...
He stopped, trailing off as though the words that followed were too painful to be spoken out loud. When he blinked, Hal saw there were tears on his lashes. She felt a sudden stabbing pain in her side, a physical manifestation of a consuming guilt.
I'm sorry.
The words were muffled by the thermometer, but they came out almost without her meaning to say them, falling into the silence Abel had left, and his head jerked up.
Don't be sorry, my dear. Whoever's fault it was, it certainly wasn't yours.
He dashed at his eyes and looked away from her, towards the shadows of the empty fireplace.
But I will say this, much as I loved Maud, much as I understood why she had to do what she did all of us a bad turn when she ran away, especially Ezra. 20 years spent wondering if she were alive or dead, and whether she would make contact one day. And now this... this bombshell. What happened to her, Harriet?
Hal felt her heart flutter as if a hand had clenched around it, constricting her blood. And for a moment she thought about feigning another faint, but there was no way she could dodge this long term. She had felt it nudging at the edge of the conversation in the drawing room the entire time the brothers were interrogating her. Felt them skirting around the topic, trying to get her to address their half-spoken questions, and she had been saved only by their very English reluctance to bring up something so personal and emotive on first acquaintance. How did your mother die? It was a hard thing to ask, and Hal had banked on them finding it so. But now, in this intimate circle of light cast from the lamp, marooned on the couch, pinned there by the blanket, now there was no escape. Clearly, whatever the truth was, Abel at least didn't know what had happened to his sister. She would have to tell her own truth, and if it didn't chime with what Mr. Tresick had found out, then that would be that. And the game would be over. What she was about to do was crossing a line, not just in terms of the risk she was taking, but also in the way she was about to use her own small tragedy in the service of something mean and dishonest. But there was no way around it. Once, a long time ago, a teacher at school had called Hal a little mouse. And the description had offended her, though she hadn't really known why. But now, she knew why. Whatever she looked like on the surface, inside, deep in the core of her, she was not a mouse. But something quite different. A rat. Small, dark, tenacious, and dogged. And now, she felt like a cornered rat. Fighting to survive. She took the thermometer out of her mouth, holding it in her hand, and drew a breath.
She died, she said quietly. Just over 3 years ago. A few days before my 18th birthday. There was a car crash. She was killed instantly, a hit and run. I was at school. I got a call.
She stopped, unable to finish, but it was done.
Oh, God,
Abel said. His voice was a whisper, and he put his hand up to his face. It was the first time that Hal had seen real grief since she had come here, in spite of Mrs. Westaway's funeral. And she felt her stomach turn at the sudden realization of what she had just done. Abel's pain was real and palpable. It wasn't just the exploitation of her mother's death that sickened her, for with that she was hurting no one but herself, but how casually she had just inflicted her own small tragedy on Abel. These are real people. She watched Abel's face in the lamplight with a kind of numbness. These aren't the imaginary rich yahoos you created on the train. These are real people. This is real grief. These are lives you are playing with here. But she could not think like that. She had started this now, and she had no choice but to see it through. She could not go back to Mr. Smith and his waiting enforcers, and beyond that to the desperate daily struggle to eat, survive, keep her head above water.
Oh, Abel, darling, Mitzi said, and her voice was a little throaty.
I'm sorry,
Abel said. He dashed at his eyes, blinking hard.
I really thought I'd come to terms with the idea of her death. I mean, we hadn't heard from her for so long. Obviously, we had all assumed. But to think that all that time, and she was alive and well, and we never knew. Dear God. Poor Ezra.
Poor Ezra? But Hal did not have time to disentangle Abel's remark, for Mitzi was speaking.
Do you think, Abel...
She began, and then stopped. When she carried on, it was hesitantly, as if uncertain of what she was about to say.
Do you think that... Why?
Why what?
Why... The will. Do you think your mother realized how she behaved? Perhaps that she had driven your sister away and perhaps felt, I don't know, guilty in some way?
A kind of atonement?
Abel asked, and then he shrugged again.
Honestly, I don't think so. God knows I've never understood mother's motives. And in spite of living with her for nearly 20 years, I have precious little insight into her thought processes. But I don't think guilt was an emotion she even registered, let alone understood. I would like to think it was something as positive as atonement, but the truth is...
He stopped, glanced at Hal, and then gave a kind of shaky laugh, as if trying to shrug off the conversation.
But listen to me rambling on. Poor Harriet still clutching that thermometer like grim death. Let's see what it says.
Hal held it out.
I'm sorry,
she said again, and she meant it now.
For all this. I'll be going tomorrow.
But as Abel held the thermometer up to the light, he whistled and shook his head.
101.5. No question of you going anywhere, young lady.
101?
Mitzi gave a little shriek.
Good Lord! You definitely cannot go home tomorrow, Harriet. I won't hear of it.
Anyway, she glanced at Abel, a quick little look, almost of trepidation.
Anyway, you'll need to stay around. There's so much to discuss. After all, this is your house now.
Chapter 15. Your house now. Your house now. The words turned sickly in Hal's gut as she lay in the darkness of the attic room, listening to the wind in the trees outside, the crackle of the fire in the grate, and the far-off crash of the sea, trying to come to terms with what had just happened. She had not had the courage to face Harding, and fortunately Abel and Mitzi had fallen in with her plea for an early bedtime. Abel had helped her up the stairs, lit the fire, and then tactfully withdrawn while she got into her nightclothes, her limbs trembling with a mix of tiredness and fever. Then, after Hal was sitting up in bed, Mitzi had appeared with a bowl of soup on a tray.
"It's only Heinz, I'm afraid," she said as she placed the tray on Hal's bedside table and straightened the contents. "Oh, bother! It's cold already. It was boiling when I left the kitchen, I swear."
"It's fine, really," Hal said.
Her voice was croaky and her face felt hot from the fire in spite of the damp chill of the bedclothes.
"I'm not that hungry."
"Well, you must eat something. Heaven knows you've got little enough to spare. Edward will be here in a few minutes, and he's going to pop up to see you before we sit down to dinner."
"Thank you," Hal said humbly. She felt her cheeks burn, not only with fever and the heat from the grate, but with the thought of what she was doing to this family and how nice Mitzi and Abel were being over it. Back in Brighton, it had seemed so different, so completely different, risking everything to snatch a few £100 from a bunch of wealthy strangers. It had seemed somehow rather gallant, a touch of Robin Hood about the whole thing. But now she was here, in their family home, and the legacy was not a few hundred, nor even the few thousand she had been half daring to hope for, but something terrifyingly huge. And what she was doing seemed anything but gallant. There was no way she was going to get away with this. The fury in Harding's eyes spoke of lawsuits and contested wills and private detectives. But it was too late to turn tail and run away now. She was stuck here, quite literally. Hal felt her stomach turn and shift, and under Mitzi's watchful eye, she took a spoonful of the soup and forced it down. There was a knock at the door as she lifted the second spoonful to her lips, and Mitzi stood and opened it. And a handsome blue-eyed man wearing a rain-spattered overcoat. He had a thick blonde moustache that was new, but in spite of that, Hal recognised him from Facebook even before Abel spoke.
"Harriet, this is my partner, Edward."
"Edward!"
Mitzi kissed him on both cheeks before ushering him into the little room. He was tall and broad-shouldered, and he seemed to fill the little space.
"Come in and meet Harriet."
"Harriet," Edward said, "delighted."
His voice was clipped as if from an expensive education, and his overcoat looked well cut and brand new, but he pulled it off and draped it carelessly over one arm before sitting on the end of Hal's bed.
"Well, it's a strange way to be meeting a new niece-in-law, but pleased to meet you, Edward Ashby."
He held out a hand, and Hal took it hesitantly, feeling the cold of his skin compared to her own hot hand.
"I won't keep you up, because I'd imagine you're probably longing to get to sleep, but Abel said you had a bit of an episode. Is that right?"
"I passed out," Hal said. "But it's nothing serious, I promise."
She tried to keep her voice from croaking.
"I'd forgotten to eat, you know what it's like."
"I don't, actually,"
Edward said with a grin.
"My stomach is sacred, and I start planning lunch around 9:30 a.m., but I'll take your word for it." "Well, you do seem to have a bit of a temperature. Any headaches?"
"Just a bruise where I hit my head,"
Hal lied. The truth was her head was aching badly, though the paracetamol had helped a little.
"Any nausea?"
"No, none."
That at least was the truth.
"And you're eating? That's a good sign. Well, I think you're probably all right, but if you start to feel sick, come and tell someone, okay?"
"Okay,"
Hal said. She coughed and then tried to smother it in her hand.
"Have you taken anything for the temperature?"
Edward asked.
"Paracetamol."
You could take an ibuprofen as well, if you want. I think I've got some.
He stood and patted first his suit pockets, then his overcoat, and finally came out with some pills. They were in an unbranded dispensary bottle, the only label a handwritten pharmacist's scribble that Hal could not make out, but he twisted off the cap and shook two out onto the table.
Thanks, Hal said. She was longing for them to leave, but she tried to smile.
Swallow them down,
Edward said, rather heartily.
You'll feel better if you do.
Hal looked at the pills. They were white and completely unmarked. Didn't pills usually have something on them saying the dosage? It came to her, a fleeting, paranoid thought that these could be anything, from Viagra to sleeping pills. But that was ridiculous, surely.
Take the pills, Harriet,
Abel said.
We don't want your temperature spiking in the night.
Rather reluctantly, Hal put them in her mouth, took a sip of water, and swallowed them down. Edward smiled as she did.
Well done, and with that, I'll leave you to your soup. Sorry we're meeting under these circs, Harriet,
Edward said as he gathered up his overcoat. Hal wasn't sure whether he meant the funeral, her head, or all of it.
But, well, sleep well. Good night, Harriet,
Abel said. He gave Hal's shoulder a little squeeze that made her flinch, just a touch. She smiled, trying to hide her discomfort.
Good night, Harriet,
Edward echoed, and with that he winked and followed Abel out of the room.
Would you tell Freddy and Kitty it's time to go to bed?
Mitzi called after them both, and Abel nodded and said something Hal didn't catch in reply.
Dear Abel,
Mitzi said, as their shapes were swallowed by the narrow, dark stairwell down to the main landing.
Such a sweet man. It's such a shame he never had children. He throws it all into his work instead.
What does he do? Hal croaked.
He's a lobbyist on behalf of various children's charities. Rather a well-known one, apparently, if you're in that particular world. But he's also simply one of the nicest people I've ever met. I can't think where he got it from, or how he survived his mother's treatment intact, but there you go. I'm sure it would have reduced anyone else to a bitter shell. But listen to me rabbiting on, distracting you.
She touched the soup tray with one finger.
You should be finishing your soup. You've hardly eaten.
I think I'm too tired to eat much. I'm sorry, Mitzi.
Hal stumbled over the name, unsure what to call her. Mrs. Westaway? Aunt Mitzi? It seemed more and more wrong, laying claim to a relationship she didn't have. Fortunately, Mitzi did not seem to notice and only sighed and stood up.
Well, manage what you can, but a good night's sleep is probably what you really need. Sleep well, my dear.
Thank you,
Hal said, or tried to, but she found her throat was stiff and the words stifled and were lost in the noise of Mitzi's feet as she turned and made her way back down the stairs to the others. After she had gone, Hal pushed away the bowl of cold, congealing soup, switched out the light, and put her hot cheek against the pillow. The fire had died down, leaving only a red glow of coals in the little grate, but there was a gap in the curtains, and the moon shone fitfully in through the bare tree branches, making abstract patterns against the white walls.
My walls,
Hal thought dazedly.
My trees.
They are not yours. The words whirled in her head, mingling with the yammering voices of the brothers, the thousand questions she needed to find answers for before tomorrow, the hundred whys and what ifs and hows.
If only the legacy had been what she had been hoping for. A couple of £1,000, as befitted a long-lost granddaughter,
That she could have claimed with few, if any, questions before slipping back into the shadows to resume her old life.
The reality felt like a terrifying millstone, weighting her down as she struggled to free herself from what she had done. There would be no quick claims here. No slipping back to Brighton to strategically lose touch with her supposed relatives. Whatever she did, whether she succeeded in fooling Mr. Tresick long-term or not, she was chained to this place now.
But why had Mrs. Westaway chosen to cut out her sons and leave everything to a girl she had never met, daughter of a woman she had not seen in years? And why had she chosen to do it this way? Springing the act upon her family after her own death, was it cowardice? It didn't seem to fit with the portrait her children were painting. The image Hal was piecing together was a woman who was indomitable, unyielding, and quite unafraid. She felt suddenly impossibly tired, her eyes heavy with an exhaustion that seemed to have washed over her all at once. Closing her eyes, she lay still in the little cot, feeling the cool of the pillow against her cheek, and listening to the sound of the house settling down for the night, feeling the suffocating presence of the Westaways all around. There was a spatter of fresh rain against the glass, and she thought she heard, though perhaps it was her fancy, the far-off sound of waves against a shore. An image came into Hal's mind. Of rising waters, closing above all of their heads, while Mrs. Westaway laughed from beyond the grave. And she opened her eyes, a sudden flood of fear making her skin prickle and shiver. "Stop it," she whispered. It was a trick her mother had taught her when she was a little girl, when the nightmares became too real. Sometimes saying the thing out loud was enough to break the spell, silence the voices inside your own head in favour of a real-life voice. The image receded, back to whatever paranoid fantasy it had come from. But the flavour of it lingered. An old, bitter woman, gone beyond harm herself, and abandoning the living to their fate. What had Hal got herself mixed up in? And what had she started? Chapter 16. When Hal awoke, the attic room was bright with sunlight, and she lay still for a long time, blinking and disorientated. There was a strange heaviness upon her, and she had to fight off the thickness of sleep and force herself to sit up, yawning and gritty-eyed, trying to remember where she was. Her situation came back with an unsettling rush. She was not safe at home, in her third-floor flat in Marine View Villas, waiting to make her way down to the pier for the day's work. She was in Cornwall, in this strange, cold house. And even before the memory came fully back, she knew from the uneasy tightness in her gut that she was in deep, deep trouble. Slowly she sat up, letting the events of the day before come back, feeling the ache in her limbs, which were heavy and limp and reluctant to obey her. She was tired. No, not just tired, more than that. Wrung out, thick-headed, as if the fog of sleep were still clinging on in the corners of her mind. As she forced her legs over the side of the bed, she remembered Edward handing her those blank, unmarked pills, and his insistence that she take them, and she shivered, not just from cold. But surely not. He was a doctor, after all. And besides, what would be the point? More likely, she was just suffering the hangover of the chill she had caught at the grave, and the effects of bumping her head. Cautiously, she put her hand up to the bruise beneath her hair, but although it felt a little tender, there was no swelling. She felt cold, but not the strange, trembly hot cold of the night before. This was just normal winter's morning cold, her feet shrinking from the chilly bare boards as she padded across the room to her suitcase, where her phone sat charging. 7:27 a.m. Early, but not stupidly so. There was also an unread text message in her inbox from a number she didn't recognize. Someone at the pier? Hal fumbled for her glasses, slipped them on, and then pressed the text message icon. 5 days, was all it said. No sign off, but Hal did not need to wonder who it was from. Gone was the sleep-fuddled dread. Instead, she was suddenly wide awake, her skin prickling with fear, as if at any moment the man with the lisp and the steel toe-capped boots might come through the door, drag her out of the narrow bed, punch her in the face.
Broken teeth. Broken bones.
She found she was shivering. I can't find you here. You're safe here. The words slowed her heart, and she repeated them like a mantra until her shaking fingers were steady enough to unzip her case. You're safe. Just get through today. One step at a time. One step at a time. Okay. The little room was unbelievably cold, her breath huffing white as she pulled on jeans and a t-shirt. At the bottom of her case was her jumper. It was bundled up with a wad of other clothes, and Hal dragged it out hastily, not noticing the tin that was caught in its folds. It fell with a thud at her feet, the lid flew off, and the tarot cards scattered across the floor like brightly coloured autumn leaves. On top was the card she had cut before the journey, the Page of Swords. His head cocked, staring defiantly out of the frame with a little half-smile, which could have been anything from a challenge to resignation. It was a card Hal had seen a million times, and she knew every detail, from the bird at his feet to the tiny tear in the top right-hand corner. But as she gathered it up along with the others, she paused for a moment, held by something in his face, trying to analyze what that could be. Whatever it was that had stopped her, it eluded her, so she dropped the cards on the bed and, with a shiver, unfolded the jumper and pulled it over her head. The familiar warmth wrapped her like a hug, and when she had put on her socks and pulled on her knee-high biker boots, she felt, in a strange way, armoured, more ready to face the rest of the family as herself, rather than the imposter she had somehow become yesterday. Finally, she raked her fingers through her hair, picked up her mobile phone from the bedside table, and looked around to see if there was anything she had forgotten. In the stark morning light, the room looked somehow different. Less spooky, perhaps, but sharper, bleaker, even less forgiving. All the details she had noticed yesterday were picked out in sharp relief. The metal bars across the window, black painted like the metal bedstead, the tiny grate no bigger than a shoebox, the damp speckled paint on the ceiling. In daylight, she could see that what she had taken for a shadow at the top of the sash window was in fact a sizable gap where it hadn't been properly closed. As she got closer, she could feel the draft from the cold air whistling through. No wonder the room was so cold. Hal put a hand through the bars and shoved at the frame, trying to close the sash properly, but it seemed to be stuck, and the position of the bars prevented her from pushing with any effective force. Nevertheless, she wriggled both hands through the bars and tried again, crouching to try to get a better angle, and as she did, something glinting on the glass caught her eye. It was a scratch on the glass. In fact, more than one. It was writing. Hal straightened, trying to make out the letters. They were tucked behind one of the bars and hard to see, but as she tilted her head to one side, suddenly the low morning sunlight caught the marks at just the right angle, illuminating them so that they glowed as if written in white fire. "Help me," it said, in tiny, crabbed capitals. Hal's heart quickened. For a long moment, she just stood there, staring at the writing, trying to understand what it meant. Who had written this? A maid? A child? And how long ago? It wasn't a cry for help. There was no hope of the message being seen from outside, or even from the inside, angled as it was. If anything, it was hidden deliberately behind the bars. Hal herself would never have seen it if she hadn't stood in this exact spot. No, this was something else. Not so much a desire to be heard, but more the expression of a thought too terrifying to keep inside. She thought of her mother, telling her to speak aloud, to dispel the nightmares inside her head, remembered her own whispered, "Stop it!" a mantra to chase away demons. Was this the same thing? Were these scratches the marks of someone trying to anchor themselves to reality, chase away the whispering voices of fear inside? "Help me." In spite of the jumper, Hal was suddenly cold. Very cold, with the kind of chill that comes from within. And inside her head was a voice she could hear, repeating the words again and again, "Help me." In her mind's eye, Hal could see a girl, just like herself, alone in this room. There were bars on the window, and a locked door. Except the door was not locked. Not for her, at any rate. And whatever had happened up here, this was not her concern. This was not her family, and not her secret, and she had better things to worry about than some long-gone girl with a penchant for dramatic gestures. Whatever had happened in this room, whatever the past of this house, it didn't matter. What mattered now was getting through today without giving herself away and finding as much information as she could about Maud. Once she had that, a birth date perhaps, even a middle name if she could somehow come up with a plausible way of finding the information, she could escape back to Brighton and forge a birth certificate that would convince Mr. Tresick. Touchwood. Touchwood. She knew what her mother would have said to that. In fact, she could picture her so exactly, the wry shake of her head, the smile quirking at the corner of her mouth. Suddenly Hal longed for her so much that it was like a physical pain around her heart. Never believe it, Hal. Never believe your own lies. Because superstition was a trap. That was what she had learned in the years of plying her trade on the pier. Touching wood, crossing fingers, counting magpies, they were lies. All of them. False promises designed to give the illusion of control and meaning in a world in which the only destiny came from yourself. "You can't predict the future, Hal," her mother had reminded her time and time again. "You can't influence fate or change what's out of your control, but you can choose what you yourself do with the cards you're dealt." That was the truth, Hal knew. A painful, uncompromising truth. It was what she wanted to shout at clients, at the ones who came back again and again looking for answers that she could not give. There is no higher meaning. Sometimes things happen for no reason. Fate is cruel and arbitrary. Touching wood, lucky charms, none of it will help you see the car you never saw coming, or avoid the tumour you didn't realise you had. Quite the opposite, in fact. For in that moment you turn your head to look for the second magpie, in the hope of changing your fortune from sorrow to joy, that's when you take your attention away from the things you can change. The crossing light, the speeding car, the moment you should have turned back. The people who came to her booth were seeking out meaning and control, but they were looking in the wrong place. When they gave themselves over to superstition, they were giving up on shaping their own destiny. Well, if there was one thing Hal had learned, it was that she would not be caught in that trap. She would shape her own life. She would change her own fortune. She would make her own luck.
Chapter 17. The drawing room where they had sat last night was empty. The ashes in the grate cold, three abandoned whiskey glasses.